This week on the Vergecast, a little bit of a Foxconn update. Google Pixel 4 reviews. We get into it with Dieter. We talk about the new Microsoft Surface hardware. Deep in the streaming wars with Julia Alexander. And what is going on with all the talent moving on the video game streaming services? That's the Vergecast coming up now.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at Deloitte.com/US/engineering advantage.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Nilay, you didn't listen to me. But that's okay, because we're going to tell you what you already knew for months.
You didn't leave us alone, leave us alone. You didn't leave us alone, leave us alone. AI meant new generation, mobility and self-driving cars.
Wait, is that the story we were running, Jeremy? Okay.
AK means smart safety and security through AK technology.
I mean, come on, Neil, you should know this.
5G means pioneering.
Wait, medical solutions? The crap is that supposed to mean?
On some health cloud network. Okay. You didn't leave us alone, leave us alone. You didn't leave us alone, leave us alone. It was just AI and K and 5G. Well, I see how that was hard to believe. You didn't leave us alone, leave us alone. You didn't leave us alone, leave us alone.
Okay, you win.
Hello and welcome to the Vergecast, the flagship podcast of Racine, Wisconsin.
Oh my God.
Hi, I'm your friend Nilay. Dieter Bowne is here.
Hi, how's it going?
Paul Miller's here.
Hello.
Julia Alexander's here.
Hey.
Julia, you're going to talk to us about streaming wars soon.
Yeah.
But I want to start with that song made by our friend Jackson Hayes. He's at Jackson H Visuals on Twitter. He's like a budding YouTuber. You should go follow him. Ring the
visuals
bell.
And audio.
And audio.
Double threat.
To explain why on earth we started with a Conor Oberst song about Foxconn, you might know that we've been covering Foxconn a lot. Just a lot. They're building a factory in my hometown of Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin. The factory, Trump called it the eighth wonder of the world. He said it would be 20 million square feet. They're going to build huge LCD panels. We're down to 1 million square feet. I will tell you that LCD experts that we have talked to are like, we've looked at these plans and there's a yoga center, but we don't see where you'd build the foundations for the LCD fabrication. So yet to be determined what will actually get built there. But while they were doing this, while Foxconn was under all this criticism during the run-up to the last election, when Scott Walker, the Republican governor of Wisconsin, obviously running for re-election on the back of making this deal, Foxconn started buying buildings in Wisconsin and saying they were going to be innovation centers. And so if you've been following this, you know that we sent Josh Jezza, our reporter, to Wisconsin. He drove around all the innovation centers around the state. He like looked in the windows and he's like, these are literally empty buildings, like not even offices, just concrete, empty spaces. And we published some photos and we got a long story, lots of interviews, all the people saying they bought the buildings, nothing's happening. So Foxconn has empty buildings in Wisconsin. Like 2 days later, Foxconn held an event where they bought another building in Madison. Alan Young, who's sort of the Foxconn executive in Wisconsin, said, the buildings are not empty. We will be issuing a statement or correction about the buildings are empty. In the meantime, we encourage you to not climb trees and investigate what we're doing, right. Which is wrong in two cases. One, we had photographs of the buildings that were empty.
Yep.
Very
and technically, there was a sawhorse in one of the buildings.
There was like a Dell, like rugged laptop in one.
Yeah.
So work getting done. And two, Josh never climbed a tree. Just putting that out there. That was, He just looked in the window.
Neelai, how many days ago was that?
That was 195 days ago, as of this recording. Okay, well, yesterday, Wisconsin Public Radio and the Wisconsin State Journal both on the same day filed reports saying the innovation centers have been put on hold and Foxconn has not actually yet done any work regarding the buildings. And I'm just going to say, I don't think that they're ever going to issue a statement or correction about the empty buildings, because I think the buildings are going to stay empty forever because they have no idea what they're doing in Wisconsin. Like, literally none. They went from 13,000 jobs to maybe 1,500 jobs. They went from building 75-inch TV panels potentially at a Generation 10 facility to promising a Generation 6 LCD fab that is not actually in the plans of the factory that they have submitted. There is a yoga center, though, and they're building another factory next to it that's going to build coffee robots. I'm not kidding. Coffee robots for airports, and also alarm system controls, like old school chunky wall panel alarm system controls for a company called Qualsys, which I've never heard of. But they definitely won't steal your personal information and sell it to the Chinese government.
Which one is the glass dome attached to?
Yes, and they're also building a giant glass dome. This is all true. None of this is – they filed plans to build a data center and a network operations center. The network operations center in the shape of a giant glass dome. They filed those plans. On the same day, they canceled those plans because this is what Foxconn does. So that was hilarious. And then a little bit later, they refiled the plans, and so we needed to make some changes to the data center. The giant glass dome will also house an auditorium. I don't know what they're doing there, man.
You actually haven't explained the Jackson song yet.
Right. In the meantime, an angry Foxconn employee repeatedly emails me screaming at me to leave them alone because everything will be fine, and trying to explain what the AI 8K 5G ecosystem is, which we've discussed at length on the show before. Another promise Foxconn has made to the good people of Wisconsin that I largely suspect no statement or correction will ever be forthcoming regarding.
AI and 8K is how you win the race to 5G.
The buildings have been empty for 196 days. I believe the buildings will stay empty forever. It's just, I don't know what they're doing there, man. I do know that the traffic by my parents' house is getting out of control.
Well, they must be doing something.
Why is there traffic if nothing's happening? I don't understand.
Because the Wisconsin state government is in service of this project is widening all the highways. So I-94 is getting bigger, and then all the service roads around the Foxconn area are getting bigger. The Wisconsin government, city, county, state, also bought a lot of people's houses and moved their houses. Like eminent domain bought their houses and tore their houses down. And now those people are like, "What? Great, thank you for paying us, but there's no factory here. Like, why did we do that?" Here's my favorite move that they're doing to hit their job number.
Making a Gen 6 LCD.
Yeah, well, if they produce even one, like, 5-inch LCD panel at this thing, it will be like a victory at this point. Like, the bar is very low. The thing that they're doing now, this is actually my favorite move. So they got to hit the number to get the tax credits, even though the state's already paid them out, and even though they're in a tax zone where those credits are actually just cash because they already don't pay taxes.
Okay.
So to get $4 billion in tax subsidies, you gotta like actually pay them cash. They've started a program called the Foxconn Earn and Learn Program, or FELP.
No.
Through FELP, they're gonna hire college students and then pay them to go to college.
What?
So they're Foxconn employees who are just in college, but then they're when you graduate, something else will happen. You're gonna earn while you learn in the program.
Got it.
And that will get them to their number. But it's unclear like what else will happen because there's no factory. But you can earn and learn.
Okay.
Help. All right. Thank you, Jackson. You're my hero. Thank you for participating in our ongoing Fox Uncovered. Now day 197 of the buildings being empty. Dieter, it's Pixel Review Week.
It is. Still. I feel like I reviewed it 1,000 years ago.
Did you earn while you learned?
I didn't know. They don't pay us for the reviews. Do not start this.
I'm just going to reveal something about the review process. So we're starting the review process. We're like editing. Dieter's outlining. And you said something to me that I just want to unpack.
Oh,
you
boy.
Said, people are already so mad about this phone. I'm just trying to come out of this alive.
Yep. I don't know that I did. I believe I referred to the YouTube video as a downvote minefield.
Yes.
Because here's why it's a downvote minefield. I like the phone. I think it's pretty good.
Yeah.
The battery life is atrocious. And, okay, atrocious is hard. The battery life in the small one is really bad. The battery life on the bigger one is acceptable, but not really acceptable by 2019 standards after we learned that you can make a phone slightly thicker and have the battery last all day, which is something Apple did. I wish that Google had just done that. But beyond that, I'm not mad about the RAM. I'm not mad about the there's a whole to-do about the screen refresh rate, which is a whole thing, and Google's real dumb. And I'm not super pleased about the face unlock drama. All the gates are bad. But people were mad about it before they knew about the gates. People were mad at this phone for not being, I don't know, the second coming, for not having a wide angle. Like, Google did a bunch of stuff that wasn't great. Like, they did a bunch of stuff that does not put this thing at the top of the best Android phone list. I specifically said it was the best Android experience, not necessarily the best Android phone. And I was talking to Dan about this. Dan Seifert runs our reviews program. And he said, Dieter, you are literally the only person that understands or cares about the distinction between best Android experience and best Android phone. I was like, I know, but I'm sticking with it.
You went for it. You did it. That was the headline.
Please. I mean, I'm trying not to be a dummy or a downvoting hater, but what's the difference
between them? Like, imagine you've gone to a theme park and, like, there's two roller coasters. And one of them you enjoy more. Like, you have more fun going on, like, the one that's, like, less crazy, you know, the Tilt-A-Whirl or whatever, right? That's your favorite ride. You enjoy it more. It's a nicer overall cohesive experience.
The Tilt-A-Whirl.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Like, you like it better. But there is the crazy loop-de-loop roller coaster that has a huge drop and, like, minute for minute has, like, more thrills, but it's rickety and the thing shakes when you ride on it. So one of those is objectively a better roller coaster because you do the loops, but the Tilt-A-Whirl is the better experience because it's not rickety and you're not afraid you're going to die.
Okay. I mean, I'm going to accept this. I'm curious about your experience at carnivals.
Okay, we've got the metaphor. Yeah. Now let's make that an Android phone thing. Link it up.
A Note 10 or a OnePlus 7 Pro or even a OnePlus 7T, you're going to get better specs. In some ways, it may like load web pages faster. You will get more camera lenses. You will get pop-up lenses. You will get, I don't know, other brighter screens, blah.
I always harp on this, a periscope inside of your phone with Huawei.
Yeah, sounds great. With the Pixel, what you get is a phone that is just overall feels more cohesive and just nicer to use. And it just, I mean, Tom Warren wrote this article. It feels more like an iPhone.
Yeah.
Like, Google tried to think through the entire experience top to bottom, and they did a much better job. The Android 10 makes way more sense here. I know what the gestures do now, and I get them. The camera is one, like, acts like one single camera instead of a bunch of different lenses. The screen refresh rate when it's on is great. The face unlock, by the way, that is the main thing. Face unlock is better than a fingerprint sensor. I know a bunch of people wish that there had been a fingerprint sensor, and they think they like a fingerprint sensor better. And I am not here to tell them that they're wrong, because I wouldn't do that. You should own your own technology preferences. However, the Face ID thing is just so much better. Face unlock is so much better than a fingerprint sensor. It just is.
Let's start there. I want to go into the why Samsung, Huawei do their thing differently, but let's start with face unlock. Of the two things about this phone that were the obvious misses, one is the battery life, which is an almost like disqualifying miss for the little one. Like, it just doesn't get as good battery life as other phones. And at this point now, phone makers are actually competing on battery life, which makes me happy. Google is not competitive, so that's a big miss. But that's like a technical miss. Like,
well, it's more than a technical miss. I do think that you can get through a day if you don't overuse it. But if you're buying the little one and you expect to like have a phone that you just like have on all the time and are using, like you're in for hurt. Don't do that.
No, I just mean like they put in the wrong part. You know what I mean? Like, you know how to fix it. They picked the wrong part. They optimized it. Face unlock is like a way bigger miss because they shipped it without. So it'll unlock the phone with your eyes closed.
Right.
And so that means they shipped it in a state that is broken.
So help me. I think I know where I land on this and that I'm mostly with you. But I've seen some people be like, actually, chill out. Like, really, this isn't that scary. Like, the threat model of someone pointing the thing at your face with your eyes closed, where you're like, ooh, my eyes are closed, haha, you can't unlock it, that you get with, like, a, you know, an iPhone, is that really that big of a difference?
Yes.
You think so? You think that there are millions of people all over the world whose phones are getting grabbed and then pointed at their face, and they're, like, trying to duck and dodge around it and close their eyes to make sure that the face unlock doesn't get ticked off?
Well, I'll do the small stakes one and then the big one.
Okay.
The small stakes one is, like, lots of people have, like, partners and roommates who would like to unlock their phones, right?
Yeah,
And that's either a little bit funny or...
not funny at all.
Yeah, my wife used to be a domestic violence attorney. Like, that was, like, a thing, right? Like, I need to get on this phone. So that's, like, small. It's small in the sense that, like, it's a personal interaction that you either care about or you don't. I think you should care about it. I think that should be the default, even in that model. Mm-hmm. The bigger one is, like... The police really like unlocking phones, right? And so if you get to the point, I mean, there have been like dozens and dozens of lawsuits that have, like, kicked all the way up to the, like, appeals court level about whether the police can compel you to turn over a passcode.
Yep.
Right? And, you know, the iPhone, if you press the right sequence of buttons in the right combination, like, it will turn off Face ID and you have to enter a passcode to get you back to that state.
Yeah, you can do that on the Pixel too. If you long press the home button, there's a lockdown button that you can tap. So it's not like the grip of security, but it is like tap, tap.
Yeah, the iPhone's like, you really, like, squeeze all the buttons and, like, freaks out for you. So if you are, I don't know, pulled over, if you are coming through customs and they can just take the phone out of your hand and lock it, like, then that's a big problem.
Yeah.
Right. And so, like I said, there's, like, the small scale one, which is, like, more interpersonal, does have some high stakes inside of it. But then the big one, which is the government has a distinct interest in unlocking phones, and Google has made that challenge much easier for them to overcome. So, like, I think that's just a problem.
The other problem is Google didn't see it. Like, it shipped with, like, little, like, caveats down in the corner. And, you know, like, if you read the fine print, you saw it. And then people started going, what? And it took Google a few days to be like, oh, no, wait, we should tell everybody we're going to issue a software update and we are actually going to fix this. So they didn't see how big a problem it was at first.
And I think that that's the miss, right? Like, we underspect the battery is, like, it's a dumb miss, but it's not, like, a we didn't think it through miss. The face unlock one is you architected a feature and you didn't even, like, look at the documentation of your competitor's feature and how we already had this conversation about Apple's implementation.
Yeah.
Like, we went through it a lot about attention detection and eyes open and blah, blah. Like, there are memes.
Yeah.
Right. There are, like, TikToks where people chase each other around parks. Like, there are comedy skits about Face ID and, like, Google didn't watch them. And so, like, that to me is a much bigger miss.
You want to know something funny?
Yeah.
The Pixel 4 does have attention detection. You can hit a setting to have the screen stay on when you're looking at it.
What are they doing?
Yeah.
Do they just want it to be faster? Like, do they just screw it up because that made it slightly faster and they didn't think anyone would notice? Like, I don't know. So that of all the gates, that one to me is the most important one. And, like, I wouldn't recommend this phone until they ship that update.
Interesting. Okay.
But, I mean, that's like a – maybe you live a life and, like, the without cops. I don't know.
Well, the other thing – I've been noticing this in, like, the Bitcoin community because it's all about securing this long password that is your Bitcoin basically. And so it's all about different methods of cybersecurity. And the mantra is that biometrics should not be passwords. You shouldn't – it's something that's based on your DNA or your fingerprint or the way you look is not something that you can ultimately have – you know for certain that, you know, a cop puts your finger on the screen or the cop holds your eyes open or something, you know, or just waits until you're not paying attention. Like, if you're trying to secure something that is very valuable to you that you do not want accessible unless you absolutely consent to it being accessed, then you shouldn't be using biometrics to secure. It's really a convenience. It's not a password.
Yeah, the argument that we've heard particularly in phone lock biometrics is this actually gets people to lock their phones.
Yeah.
So people were using nothing, and so this is a huge step up from nothing.
It's, like, really interesting to listen to people talk about privacy because, like, objectively, privacy is important. But also, up until very recently, my password on my phone was 0000.
Julia.
0000.
Was there at least, like, a lot of zeros? Was it, like, 8 digits of zero?
It was, like, the gif of Kanye going, like, 0000 very fast.
Apple actually refers to that as the Kanye code.
Yeah, so I had the same code as Kanye.
Like when you're at events or briefings and you're like, what's the audio unlock? They're like, Kanye code.
Now it's no longer that. People who try to steal my phone.
It's all ones.
Now it's 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay, so that's that stuff.
Yeah.
The part I wanted to get to was like Samsung and Huawei, they don't control the software the way that Google does.
Right.
And so they are obviously competing on hardware. Like they're doing, like when you squeeze the balloon, that's where they go. Mm-hmm. Google has it all. And it's mm-hmm. weird they didn't overextend the hardware and they obviously emphasize the software polish. Or is it?
No, it's not weird at all. I think that Google doesn't, I don't know. What high-end hardware do they make? They make the Pixel Book from a couple years ago. And everything else is still kind of mid-range, right?
Yeah.
Like what's their premier, holy crap, this is the nicest thing ever hardware?
The Google Home Max.
I guess.
I'm just sure. Putting it out there. That's it, I think.
Yeah. Just institutionally, that's where they live. Now, the question is, what's going to happen next year? Because next year, we are expecting a radical iPhone revision. We're expecting more 5G phones, possibly from Apple, possibly from Google. And next year will be, I think, the year where Rick Osterloh, the head of hardware, is directly managing phone hardware at Google.
Are you already at next year? This phone came out like last week.
Everyone's already at next year with the iPhone.
They're like, already at next year for the iPhone. They're selling more iPhones 11 than anybody anticipated.
Yeah.
You can't already be at next. Like, the phone has already been discounted $100 like twice. It's been out
That's
for
true.
2.5 days. Like, your curtain raiser was it's about more than the camera. We haven't even talked to the camera yet, but it's about more than the camera.
Yep.
And this is the year they have to do it. And we talked to Rick, and he's like, we're in all carriers. We're going to market the phone. They're running the ads. And we're already at, well, next year. That's nuts.
Well, I mean, it's nuts, but the phone is very good other than the battery life. And they're going to, assuming they fix the Face ID thing.
Like, yeah.
I enjoy using this phone more than I enjoy using a Note.
Okay.
And it's not just that I like prefer the like slightly cleaner Google experience. It's like the whole thing feels more cohesive than a Note does, or a Galaxy S10, or even a OnePlus, although OnePlus gets a little bit closer. So they still can try to market the hell out of this thing. But I don't know. I just, every time we ask about it, we're like, are you going to do it? Like, I don't see them making the Super Bowl commercial with like the, you know, the darkness like yeah. Samsung did. Like, that's what sold the Galaxy phones. That's why Galaxy phones, like they just blanketed the universe with advertising and really expensive high-end advertising. And I just don't think Google has it in them to do that. And given the reception of this phone, I think it would actually probably be a mistake.
I mean, it's the reception of this phone with like true nerds, our people.
Yeah.
You pull over in your car, feel great. You're one of us. You write songs about Foxconn for us. You're one of us, right? Like, out in the world, like, it has a great camera. It's an Android mm-hmm. phone. It's a little bit cheaper than the flagship Android phones. It's a pretty yeah. good sell. It works like an iPhone. That's not subtle. Like,
yeah.
You can unlock it with your face and you can swipe around like an iPhone. It is not, yeah. that part is not subtle. Google could make the sale. I just think, I don't know, actually, you've said this now several times, like, Samsung sells a lot of phones because it advertises the phones. Samsung will also just let any carrier do whatever it wants on
yeah.
their phones. Like, if
yeah.
you want a slightly custom Galaxy S10, Samsung's like, we already actually made that for you. Bixby actually yeah. predicted your specific needs, AT&T. Now there are 4 email apps on our phone, and one only uses the email app that AT&T wrote that just reads email to all AT&T employees as you send it. So like, they will do that. Google, I think, will not do that. I think that's
Hopefully
the thing
not.
That's going to keep them out of carrier marketing deals. That's the thing that's going to keep the salespeople in carrier stores from earning commissions on Google phones. Like, there's a whole yeah. dirty world of stuff that Samsung is very, very good at.
Yep.
And that puts them at the top. And part of it is just like straight bribes to sell the phones. And part
yeah.
of it is marketing. And part of it's like really glossy marketing. I don't know if Google is ready for that. They certainly know about it. Like, Rick Osterloh is no stranger to that world.
Yeah.
The question is whether he wants to do it.
I imagine they want to see if they can get away with not doing it. I also just want to point out, I mean, it's earnings season, and like I'm sure that Google won't break out hardware, and people will be like, how much are you making on hardware? And they're like, blah, 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 it's fine.
Google won't tell how much money they make on YouTube.
Nope.
Even if they don't go all out, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a failure. You know, when we ask them, what's your metric of success, we always get the like, oh, it's customer satisfaction. And like, it's like, fuck you, bullshit. But it's also, yeah, okay. But on the other hand, like, you don't actually need to sell these things. So what are you making it for?
Can I ask a bit of a meta question? Like, what does it matter to us that these are successful? Is it so that Google keeps on making them so that they keep, you know, skin in the game of Android being good and not just something that they shovel to random companies.
Yeah, I mean, it's, to me, it's the most important thing about the Pixel is the thing that was important about the Nexus line, which is Google needs to be good at making Android and make Android good on phones. And you can't make a good phone operating system unless you have a phone. Like, you need to be able to test it on real hardware that's forward-looking.
I will say, like, I've, as a Pixel 3 user, as Android 10 has, because it was in beta for a very long time, so I feel like I was it was slowly being revealed to me and I was being experimented on with all these gestures. But now that it's really landed, they've definitely improved my phone. Mm-hmm. Sadly, my one major problem remaining is the battery life.
Paul, I have a slightly different answer to that question, which is going to be unsurprising to everyone, which is I think the world needs more than two dominant phone makers.
Yep.
And Google can pay for it. Google can wait it out to get in the game. And I think it is pretty bad if everyone's choices are a clean Apple experience that is very locked down and controlled, or just the chaos carnival of the Samsung phone, and there's literally no in-between choice.
Yeah.
And I think what Google did with the Pixel camera pushed everybody else way, way faster than they would have gotten there before.
Yeah, nobody would have gotten there without the Pixel camera. Completely agree.
So I think the part of the answer is I want this thing to succeed just because it guarantees that every other vendor has to try hard. It sets a high watermark on certain metrics. But to Dieter's point, it also makes Google have to try. And if Google just like relaxes and like Android is a dominant player in the ecosystem, it's the most popular operating system in the world, like we're just going to let it be Windows, like that's horrible. So like I think the fact that Google feels like it has to make a polished, complete thing that is an expression of Google, which basically the Pixel is, that's actually pretty good, right? And it sits next to the iPhone. Whether or not anyone's going to buy that this phone is more helpful than the iPhone, which is like Google's free, like, sure it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's more helpful in the sense that the Google Assistant is but one button away, but like, so is Siri. And unless you are, again, listening to this show and you know that this precise outer limits of Siri compared to the precise outer limits of the Assistant, I don't know, the phone's more helpful.
Yeah, no, Google's way better than Siri. I don't know. I just don't tell you.
But like to set a timer and to like turn on a light.
Okay, I've said a lot about the camera. I mean, everybody knows what I've said. I think that it's still bad on video. But Neil, you've played with the camera. What do you think?
I'm surprised at how much it's just sort of the iterative update to the camera.
Yeah.
The video thing is shocking to me. Like Samsung uses the same 855. Mark Lavoie told us they're using the processor to do their imaging stuff, not the Pixel Visual Core or whatever custom silicon they're doing. It's the processor that actually does all the work. So you would think that if Samsung can do all the work on the processor, Google could do all the work on the processor. And it just, they own YouTube. They are, they had a bunch of YouTubers at the thing. And all the YouTubers are like, 4K 30, huh? Like they just looked openly confused. So that's just a bizarre miss to me. I don't get it at all. I love that they know that they have a look in that camera and they hit that look. And I personally really, really like that look. They actually turned it down this year, they told us. And I think I can see it. What's weird is that the look is going to come to the other cameras in the range. So like the Pixel 3 is going to start to look like the Pixel 4, which is really interesting to think about as a camera. Like when you buy a Nikon, you don't expect that a software update will just change the way the camera looks after a while. Mm-hmm. But it's going to happen here because it's computational photography and that sort of stuff can happen.
Yeah. Just so it's clear, like the look is coming, but most of the features aren't, or a lot of the features aren't. So one of my favorite features is the dual exposure sliders. So there's one that's for brightness, overall brightness, and then there's one just specifically for shadows, and then you get a live preview of it. That's what the neural core does, apparently. And that being able to like get the blacks exactly where you want them actually is great.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's really cool. Their camera is I say camera in terms of like the app and then the photos it produces, like that experience of I'm going to make a photo and then here's a photo. Is better than the iPhone, but it just is. It gives you more controls. It treats you with respect that you're not a total dummy, right? Like, I appreciate that. Maybe that's like a big argument, right? Do you want to clutter up the viewfinder with a bunch of controls, or do you just want to look at a big preview of what you're going to get And Apple's way better at providing you with live previews. They do a live portrait mode. They do, like, they've already done the live HDR stuff. And just take a picture, not worry about it. Right? Like, vastly different philosophies here.
But here again, Google is in the middle because Samsung and Huawei, they will give you, you know, control settings for days that are either right there in the main camera app or just like a half a swipe away. If you like blink at it, all of a sudden you've got ISO controls, right?
Yeah.
And so Google does, you know, in fact, fall a little bit in the middle.
But Samsung and Huawei, like, they give you all these controls and they produce, like, arguably worse photos.
Yeah.
Well. Like, you can't – all those controls don't get you to a photo that's as good as the iPhone. The thing that I think that I've landed on with the, after all of this – and Deep Fusion still isn't out, so I can't even be totally definitive. I think Apple solved all their iPhone problems with raw horsepower, right? They just put in a better sensor. It's a way less noisy sensor. They're doing way less noise reduction. They have a slightly faster telephoto lens so they can go to higher shutter speeds. It is just a sharper camera. And then they're doing all whatever smart HDR stuff they're doing. And then, you know, sweater mode will hit whenever it hits the next few weeks. It's already in beta. And then maybe the computational photography stuff will be the big upgrade. Right now, it's just smart HDR. It's doing the same stuff it was doing before. And I think they solved that problem with the sensor. Google is using, they told us, an off-the-shelf sensor. The photos are just less sharp. They're, in many cases, more aesthetically pleasing out of the box, and you can, like, you have to tweak an iPhone to get there, but...
So, but the thing that illustrates this difference is the photos are less sharp except in low light with moving objects or if your hand is moving. In those cases, because Apple just brute forced it and they do longer exposures and they don't do as much math, they have more blur in low light because longer exposures create more blur, the end. But Google just does more math, and so they can get sharper photos in those situations because they just take more and shorter frames. And so in bright light, the iPhone 11 can be sharper because it's just a better lens, basically, right? It's a better system there. And so they can just do that work directly and not have to compute it, whereas Google does have to compute it so you can see it in the detail in bright light.
Yeah, I think I don't know if I totally agree with that. I think they were getting it before and they were doing all the same math, and then they were just they had to do noise reduction, and it just destroyed it was just destroying their pictures.
When you say they, you're referring to
Apple.
Okay.
So I went back and looked. Like, one of the things I feel most validated about, like, having reviewed phones for years, is I said the 10S camera wasn't great and everyone yelled at me. Mm-hmm. And then you go back and look at, like, the Reddit threads and Apple support forums, and there's, like, dozens and dozens of messages where, like, why are my photos so noisy? Why is this noise reduction destroying my photos? And it's like, yeah, that's the thing. So I think the sensor is just less noisy. I don't know if the math is different, but sweater mode is coming.
Yeah.
And that might change how they do it.
Everything could be different or not. Hard to see.
It really looms over us like a ghost in the night.
I want people to think of cameras for people like me. Okay, I need to do a rapid video really quickly to get some meme potential on TikTok, which means I need it to be stabilized, I need it to zoom in really quickly, and I need it to look decent.
You should buy an iPhone.
Yeah, I mean, I have an iPhone 7, I think, and I like
it. That's an iPhone 8.
This is an 8? I have an iPhone, and it does its job decently. but I want a better camera to get that TikTok clout.
Yeah, so you should just buy an iPhone 11.
Okay. There we go.
It's just a very easy answer. that's what Apple has, like, really done with the video stuff, right? Like, the world communicates in video, and, like, there you go. It's a better video camera. And Google just missed that one. Are we going to continue arguing about photos forever? We are. Are we having a live Vergecast next week in San Francisco with Isaac Reynolds, the product manager of the Google Pixel camera, and Robbie Stein, the head of product for Instagram, together on stage to talk about how the platform affects the camera and the camera affects? We are doing that next week in San Francisco at the Glass Room in Mozilla. It's already sold out, but you should go to our website and get in the waiting list in case one person drops out.
I think in this conversation, part of why this phone is so controversial is crystallized in my mind. Let me express it to you. Google built a cool radar and they put it in a phone.
But yeah.
They could have spent more money on a camera.
Or a bigger battery.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about Sully, which
no
one seems to care about.
It makes the phone slightly nicer in ways that you will never notice. And the gesture thing you might use every now and then, maybe, to, like, change songs. But, like, that's not a real feature.
Have you gotten any false positive? Like, accidental song skips because you were gesturing during a conversation while also listening to music?
I have gotten a couple where I was like reaching for a coffee cup and it was on the other side of the phone.
Wow.
So, that's all I want to hear.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about the last gate. Hertz gate.
Hertz gate. The gate. The Hertz are gated. So it has a high refresh rate screen, but it dynamically ratchets it down to save battery life, depending on what's happening. And the thing that we didn't realize is it ratchets that refresh rate down in situations that we wouldn't have thought of, like when the screen brightness is low, or when the more accurately, I think, is when ambient light is low. Because if it's dark out, they just figure, I don't know, you won't notice the screen refresh rate. I don't know.
I actually don't understand this at all.
I don't understand this decision at all. It's very confusing. But you can see it. So like everyone said, oh, if you drop below 75%, then the refresh rate goes down. And so I did that and didn't. I was confused. And then I covered the ambient light sensor and dropped down to 60 immediately. So I was like, oh, that's odd. Ask Google. Google says, we've already been working on this. We're going to put out another software update in the coming weeks instead of the coming months that will like allow 90 hertz to stay in more situations. I don't know. It does explain why it took so long for us to shoot B-roll for the video review, because we kept on like having to adjust our camera settings because the screen kept changing. We couldn't figure out why, because we didn't want banding. You know, you get that on refresh rate. This is a thing where I have a hard time getting super mad about it. It is annoying, and I wish that it were just a little bit clear when you're at 90 and when you're not, because you know, it just would be nice to know what you're getting. But I chalk this up to like, I don't know, Google being Keystone Cops, not Google being like conspiracy theory zone. Like they're not, it's just like they didn't think it through all the way.
But is the promise of this phone is that they've thought through the hardware and software together in perfect synchronicity.
Yeah. And they did. It feels more so than like Samsung. Like it's a low bar you're comparing it to, right?
But there's another high bar.
Another high bar. And they don't quite hit that bar. Except that Android is like better at so many things than iOS. Like notifications are still 1,000 times better on Android than it is on iOS.
Samsung just has like an always on screen control. That's like, what refresh rate would you like? Talk to Bixby.
Yeah.
Here's what I don't understand about that specific problem. Bright screens suck up battery. Mm-hmm. High refresh rates suck up battery. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't it be exactly the other way around? If the concern is battery life, that when the screen's really bright, they're like, it's blinding you, so persistence of vision will make it appear as though it's going fast. So we're going to ratchet it down to save the brightness.
But if the screen is really bright, they can probably assume that you're like looking at it. Whereas if you ratchet the screen brightness down, they're like, they don't care how this looks. They're trying to save battery life. They've ratcheted the screen brightness down.
Yeah.
I'm not defending this. I'm trying to figure out what the thing is.
But if the goal is to save battery life, why would you be like, you know, when the one thing that eats battery is active, we definitely want the other thing that eats battery to be active.
But they know if you crank the screen brightness up that you're looking
at it. They don't know what I'm thinking.
Okay.
Get out of here, Google. You haven't tracked me that well. By the way, I do want to say this about the software, because we mentioned it twice. Google has some problem. They promised us some updates. It seems a little chaotic. That actually, at this moment in time, is just par for the course of our industry. It's not even worth noting. Apple put out the iPhone 11, and then they were like, iOS 13.1 is coming. And then they released like 15 updates along the way to 13.1. And they're going to release the actual software feature of the camera is still in beta and is not out yet.
Yep.
Samsung released a phone whose fingerprint sensor could be thwarted by any fingerprint, and they promised a software update for it. So that we're just at a point where these phones are definitely coming out way ahead of their software being finished.
What if everybody just took a year off?
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Well, can't they just do like what gaming does? Like gaming, I mean, not the crunch aspect, but like they delay a lot, and it's just because now it's become so common to just say we need a polish, so we're taking another 4 months. I mean, it sucks, but it's like,
yeah. Yeah. Or like console cycles, like this is your phone for 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so with video games, they know that their fans are just going to buy them whenever it comes out. But with phones, they need to have it in time for hardware. The reason that fall is so crazy is because they need everything ready for holiday season.
But what if we break the bounds of our calendar?
Yes.
I'm just saying. The calendar has been imposed upon us. It is a system that's thousands of years old. It doesn't even make any sense. What if we just start buying everything in late summer?
Sure. Like that's what Amazon's doing with Prime Day, right? Right,
oh, man.
Midsummer.
That's how they get
Jeff
you.
Was ahead of you.
Bezos. All right, we got to take a break. We'll come back and curse Jeff Bezos a little more in a second.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline. Because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.
Dieter, some other reviews this week of note.
Yeah.
Surface Pro 7, which Tom reviewed, the Surface Laptop 3, 15-inch, specifically a 15-inch, which Dan reviewed.
Yes.
Walk us through it.
The Surface Pro 7 is like, yep, you made another Surface, you updated the processor, and you put USB-C on it finally. Thanks. But what they didn't do was update the industrial design, reduce the screen bezels, or do anything else. They just kept on putting it out there. Like the Surface Pro 7 is very much like... Well, the factory stopped making the old one. Now we're making the new one. Enterprise companies, please continue to buy this thing. It continues to be like the default 2-in-1. And it has gone from like pretty inspiring to like pretty expected and starting to feel a little bit dowdy. Tom said that he wished that it looked like a Surface Pro X, which is the fancy ARM one with all the fancy stuff. And he's not wrong.
Yeah.
To me, I if you want to keep talking about the Surface Pro 7 for the next half an hour, like we did with the Pixel, we can, but there's literally nothing else to say about it. They didn't change the screen resolution. They didn't change any. It's another Surface Pro 7.
Dieter Bone's Surface Pro 7 podcast challenge, go.
At least they put USB-C on it. Let's talk about USB-C and specifically USB-C PD power delivery.
Please stop.
And whether or not you can get Lightning 3 on it.
Okay, but the 15-inch Surface Laptop 3 is actually interesting just in the fact that it exists. Because it doesn't seem like it needs to exist.
If you asked somebody, all right, there's an expensive 15-inch laptop. What is it for? They'd be like, oh, it's for like pro users and it's for people that want to edit video. And no. No, that's not what the Surface Laptop 3 15-inch is. It's just a big Surface laptop. If you want a Surface laptop that has all the nice Microsoft things and the option to have Alcantara fabric and, you know, like you can trust it and there's not extra crapware on it. There's just like a little bit of crapware on it because Microsoft still is screwing that up. You just want a 15-inch screen, you can just go get that. And so what's fascinating to me is for a long time, the conventional wisdom was 15-inch Windows laptops sell really well because people just want big screens. And so there's always a giant pile at Best Buy of kind of crappy laptops that run Windows, but they have 15-inch screens. And so people buy them. I've seen these laptops in the homes of friends and family, or rather friends and their parents of friends and family.
And they all have hilariously low-res screens, so everything's big on them.
Yes.
15-inch, 1024 by 768. Let's go.
Yeah. So I think that the Surface version of that, the Surface Laptop version of that is, what if we just made that but nice, and then people who want to spend the extra money to get the nice version of that will just be able to buy it?
Yeah.
That's why I think it exists.
I think that's right. I think we've talked about this a lot lately. It's kind of a new thing that we've noticed, but like the big cheap screen is an under-remarked product category across everything that we cover. Like, you want a $700 75-inch TV that effectively cannot produce black, it will only produce gray. Yep, we get like the walls upon walls of them at your local store because people just want that thing. And like 15-inch laptop, you want an iPhone 11 that's a big screen that's a little lower resolution, here you go, it's cheaper than last year. Like, it's a big cheap screen and that's what people want.
Yeah.
And I think this is just a little tick nicer of a big cheap screen is not a bad place for Microsoft to play.
Well, this is the theme with like Google stuff too. Like, people are very unhappy with the Pixel 4 pricing, but like you're just paying for the nicer thing. In fact, By the time this is out, I will have published the review of the Pixelbook Go, which is a slightly nicer. It's a Chromebook that is $100 more than like the raft of $500 Chromebooks that you can buy. And it's just like a nicer object. But otherwise, it's the same thing. You're just paying a little bit more for it to not have a micro SD card expansion slot.
But why is it a 16:9 screen? That's the thing that kills me about that.
It's very infuriating. People must not care. I don't know. A bunch of the other Chromebooks in the space are 16:9. There's a factory that makes Chromebooks, and that it's like GM. There's like one factory that makes all the cars, and then like Pontiac and Chevy and whatever just customize a little bit. That's what Chromebooks are right now.
Is that factory in Racine, Wisconsin? I thought you were going to say there's a factory that makes 16:9 screens. And I was like, I know where that factory is not located.
Does that factory make this Pixelbook?
I don't know. I don't think so because it doesn't have the micro SD or the USB-A and all the other Pixelbooks do, or all the other Chromebooks do, excuse me. Anyway, the point is, the Pixelbook's fine. It's boring. Don't buy one, buy the Asus. Anyway, the point is, Microsoft and Google are both just making hardware that on a spec level or a price level or just a like head-to-head competitive level are worse in some ways, but they're nicer objects and they have the logo on them from the company you trust. And so they just charge a little bit more.
Yeah. And it's fair.
Yeah.
I feel like a nice but relatively cheap 15-inch laptop is actually a very rare thing right now.
Yeah. And I think Microsoft saw that sort of market hole.
Yeah. Right? Because there's the $400 15-inch and then there's the $1,500 or really closer to $2,000 Pro 15-inch. But this was a hole, I think. And I'm glad that they went for it.
Yeah. I mean, I have like, I think most people have, Dieter was talking about it, like the army of like various aunties who have horrible 15-inch Windows computers. Mm-hmm. And the problems they have with those computers make no sense to me. Like I got the call one day and it was like, I picked up my computer and like the keyboard fell out and I was like, I don't just like throw the whole thing away. Like, I don't know, man. Like, yeah. I can't troubleshoot that for you. Like, yeah, it's made of, it's a basically hollow plastic shell with at this point, like a tiny little motherboard in the center. Mm-hmm. Like just throw it away. See what happens when you light it on fire. That'll be a good YouTube video.
One last Surface Laptop thing to bring up. iFixit tore down the Surface Laptop 3, the 13-inch, and Microsoft told the truth. They did make it way easier to repair. They haven't taken it as far as they should. It's still at a 5. And they still say that you should only allow a technician to replace the SSD, which did we all become like static monsters in the past 5 years?
Dieter, there's something I need to tell you about villains? Earth in 2019.
Everyone changed their components all the time on laptops 5 to 10 years ago, but now you're supposed to have a technician do it? Come on. Anyway, good on Microsoft for improving repairability. They have further to go, though.
Yeah, we were talking to Panos about it. I really think it's because they sell so many to enterprise.
Yeah.
Like, you cannot, like, I see Surface Pro units, like, in enterprise applications, like, all the time. They're just, like, floating around.
Yeah.
I think they want to get those laptops in the same spaces, and you cannot do that unless you can actually, if they're made of glue, you can't sell them to a fleet that needs to repair them. So I think there's another pressure beyond just, we all like Kyle and iFixit, and we think that he has good ideas about the future of computers. Like, that's all true. I just don't think that was like enough pressure to make Microsoft re-architect the laptop.
Fair.
All right, Julia. Mm.
I don't have a Microsoft Surface Day. I'm sorry.
That's not, well, I mean, I wish, if you do, feel free to chime in.
Microsoft Word is dope. That's but we're, my take.
It really is.
Underrated application. No, I wanted you on specifically because we're in the lull, the calm before the storm.
It's so exciting.
Apple TV Plus is coming out.
Yep.
Disney Plus is coming out.
Yep.
These CEOs are at conferences talking.
They're calling out Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, Bob Iger's
my
like,
boy.
Who gives a shit about your opinion? It's like basically what Bob Iger said about Scorsese. The parties for the shows are happening.
Yep.
The Apple TV app is now out. It's out on Roku and Amazon Fire stuff. Verizon is offering a bundle of Disney Plus, which is a net neutrality nightmare. I told you. It's all happening. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting. So, Apple TV Plus is gearing up to launch. Actually, if you go into iTunes, because I did that, because it's 2019, I went into iTunes and there's a bunch of ads for Apple TV Plus, which is exciting. Basically, just please grab this. This is Apple's attempt to erase its past, right? This is Apple being like, remember when we did Planet of the Apps? No, you don't, because we don't want you to remember it. Gwyneth Paltrow doesn't remember it, so it's fine. Remember when we did carpool karaoke?
Gwyneth Paltrow memory hold being in Spider-Man.
What does she
remember?
This is the power of being Gwyneth Paltrow, though. It's an interesting time because Apple is coming out first in this kind of six-month launch window we have for about five or six services. And in many ways, this feels like the beginning of Apple wanting to follow Jeff Bezos and create a Prime bundle. Right? This is what we're expecting. Apple TV Plus will be to Apple what Amazon Prime Video is to Amazon. And eventually you'll just be trapped in the Apple ecosystem and then you won't get out of it. And so they're...
Eventually.
I mean, because eventually we'll get
a
bundle.
Let me tell you what it's like on the inside, Julia.
people who aren't Neli, like eventually you're going to have Apple Music and Apple News and Apple Arcade and Apple
You'll never
Plus.
Hear anything about China ever again.
Yeah. And then you'll buy iCloud storage and you'll just be in this world. And so that's kind of like the exciting thing for Apple. They've got a lot of money, more money than anyone else in this space. So they can just give a shit ton of money to people. They gave Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston $1 million an episode for a show that's not out yet. And gave them $250 million to make a version of The Newsroom, which is insane.
It's called The Morning Show. That's their big launch.
Right.
That's the show.
It's the coming. Show.
It's like all their effort is around The Morning Show.
Yeah, it's based on Brian Stelter at CNN, his book about The Morning Show Wars. But with a Me Too kind of hinge on it. And so, yeah, I mean, they're launching. It's kind of exciting. Disney is like the big one in terms of disrupting. Disney is the one that every investor is looking at because they have the potential to not necessarily destroy Netflix. Like, no one is going to destroy Netflix. But Disney has the potential to grow up to 120 million subscribers in, like, 5 years. They have the potential to be very disruptive and change the theatrical going experience for a lot of people, change how money is flowing between consumers when they go to theaters or whether buying, subscribing to different things. So it's like a weird time, but an exciting time. Martin Scorsese said it's probably the most exciting time in Hollywood since he's been in it.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
He's been around for a long time.
He's been around. He's been around Hollywood during like the good days.
So all of this is happening.
Yeah.
This week, Netflix like had an earnings call.
Yeah. And they, CEO,
are they doomed?
They don't think so. So the thing about Netflix.
Good.
Yeah.
That'd be amazing. Every day seems like, we're calling it.
Could you imagine? Sorry, guys. I'm moving on. Which Reed would probably have a very funny comment. But Reed Hastings came out and said, like, for the first time, was basically like, we have competition. We know that. We are basically telling our investors to prepare for a little bit of turbulence, like pilots tell you when you fly through a cloud or whatever. But we're going to come out the other side like most flights do. we're going to be fine. is basically how Reed Hastings feels, which is true. I mean, they've got a huge start on things. They're in countries like India and South America, which is a huge market that's untapped. So, yeah, they're going to be totally fine. But they are also taking on $2 billion more in debt. So that brings their debt up to about $14 billion. They've never been profitable. They're just trying to compete, essentially. And what they're trying to compete with more than anything else is not Disney. They're trying to compete budget-wise with Amazon and Apple. And that's two different things, right? If you think of Amazon and Apple as like a service industry, right? So they've got hardware. Apple's got hardware that they make a lot of money on. Amazon's got a huge retail service to make a lot of money on. They can just spend money on video and it doesn't matter to them. It's like, hey, if you're here, we have this thing for you. All Netflix has is its subscribers. Like, that is it. And so they can only say, you know, their head of content, Ted Sarandos, basically said this, where he's like, we can't keep buying shows for $500 million. Like, this is not something we can, which they did with Seinfeld. This is not something we can continue to do. A company like Apple can go, okay, yeah, but we can. And so they'll just do it. And so that's something that Netflix has to kind of figure out how they're going to compete against. The one thing they have going for them is that Apple wants family-friendly television, and Netflix is basically like, we don't care. We'll take anything. And will produce anything. And so they have that relationship with creators. They have that going for them. They know they've produced hits. But give Apple a few years. I mean, Apple is working with Oprah and possibly working with the Obamas, who knows, based on paparazzi photos.
No, the Obamas have a Netflix deal. They just went out to dinner.
But they have a Netflix
Tim
deal now.
Cook, by the way, the photo is Tim Cook and Robert De Niro and Barack Obama were at dinner together in New York.
They have a Netflix deal now. Who knows?
I would have just watched. I would have, if Netflix had just put that on, I would just like, here's $8 a month. Like, I don't, just give me this an hour a month of that conversation.
They just do a podcast.
Yeah. It's just Robert De Niro being like, what the fuck? And Obama being like, what the fuck? And then like Tim Cook being like, I don't swear.
The thing is, they have deals now. everything is going to change in the coming years, which is why it's really exciting. But Apple is poised.
But Apple's not buying this library stuff. So Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Right. Like Netflix buys older shows, like famously Friends gets batted around for millions of dollars. Yeah. They're buying Seinfeld because they're losing Friends to AT&T, which is such a nightmare sentence that we're going to be forced to say a lot. Apple isn't buying that. They're paying for new stuff.
Apple isn't buying it yet. I mean, Apple is trying to buy exclusivity, right? So they reportedly offer J.J. Abrams $500 million to just work with them specifically. And J.J. is a guy who's like, I want to make more Star Wars movies. I want to do 9,000 things. I want to make probably another Star Trek. I don't want to work with just Apple. I will work with you on something, but I want to do that. And so he turned that down and reportedly took a $250 million deal with Warner Media, AT&T, to do stuff with them because he's been with HBO for so long, which made a lot of sense. But that's the type of thing Apple's doing. They're coming out and going, we will give you money. We want you to work exclusively with us. They've renewed all their shows. None of them have premiered yet. You do that for certain shows in Hollywood. You do that for The Walking Dead and The Big Bang Theory, where you're like, people will tune in. It's fine. Like, don't worry. Just keep it going. Apple's renewing shows that no one has heard about. And they're like, it doesn't matter. Like, we have the money. We'll just do it. Disney's doing the same thing. Disney's already going out there and be like, yeah, it's fine. We'll renew it. It just makes sense. We need content. And so for Netflix, they're kind of stuck in this boat where they're like, well, we have a lot of shows that we can continue renewing, but we're burning our content budget really fast. We're trying to do too much right now, in my opinion. They're trying to do movies and like buy theaters and figure out exactly who they are. And so what we're seeing happen is them trying to figure out where they can advance in a space. And they know that they can't compete with Apple's budget. They know they can't compete with Disney's catalog. So now they're just kind of going.
Wait. Disney's catalog, like they announced all those movies and like out of the vault. And it's like, wait, this catalog is maybe not as good as everyone has been fearing. It's like, Disney went through a very creatively fallow period for about 20 years.
You have to remember that for 1 year, I believe in the 70s, Disney was run by an NFL player. Because they were just like, what? I can't remember his name, but he was like,
yeah, he obviously like, didn't make a mark.
Yeah, it was for
either
1 year.
Either in the NFL or as the CEO of Disney.
It was 1 year. I mean, so the thing about Disney, right, is that Disney had a large period where no one knew what they were doing. They were making movies about dogs and like chimpanzees, and it was like, I don't know, we'll just make movies. Then in 1989, The Little Mermaid comes out. Michael Eisner, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who's now doing Quibi, take over, and they lead this charge, right? And that like, runs up to 1984 when Katzenberg is then fired. And so things kind of change around then. And then the Disney people know today is really the Bob Iger era, which is 2004, 2005. The lot of the things that people want to subscribe to Disney Plus for are not going to be there. So Marvel is a great example, right? You're not going to get most Marvel movies because of rights problems. Disney does not own the rights to a lot of Marvel movies in terms of streaming. So they have to figure out how they're going to bring this over to their streaming service, which means it's going to take about a year before you really start seeing things appear on the service. But that said, Disney has a lot of things going for it. They have new original series. They have all of Star Wars. They have all of Pixar. They have all of their Disney animated stuff. And if you're a parent, $6.99 a month means that you don't have to worry about them being on YouTube and seeing some stuff they don't want to see.
Yeah.
It's got most things that will keep your kids entertained. And the thing about bad 1960, 1970 Disney movies is like we don't like them because we're adults and we have taste. But like kids do not have taste.
Kids are stupid.
kids will just watch whatever. And like a talking monkey is like hilarious to like a 5-year-old and me. And so it's like they will watch it. Disney has no problem. The fact that they're also doing a year with Verizon for free is like, I mean, investors alone are like, oh, they're going to do way more. They're going to do way better than we thought they were going to do.
Can I just tell you the story of Ronald William Miller, the CEO of Disney?
There it is.
He played for the Los Angeles Rams, and he got knocked unconscious in a game. And Walt Disney, and this is, I'm just reading it. He said, I don't want to be the father to your children. You're going to die. How about you come work at Disney? And then he became the CEO of Disney.
That's what I mean. This was this company for a minute. It was like a weird company.
That's incredible.
Wow.
That's what happens when you marry in the Disney family. Walt personally is like, don't die out there. How about you run this animation studio instead?
Yeesh.
But anyway, so this is, to me, the problem with Netflix.
Right.
Coming back to this library argument. Netflix has paid for a lot of stuff over the past few years. They have let their creators have free reign. They're very famous, very like creator-friendly, artist-friendly.
Yeah.
They just have a lot of very slow-moving shows.
Yeah.
Right, there's not a lot of, they don't have a lot of hits, actually.
No. Nope.
They have Stranger Things, they had House of Cards. Hyperdrive. Hyperdrive is great.
Hyperdrive is great.
Hyperdrive is like my favorite show. They have like Chef's Table, but Chef's Table is very much a like, watch this chef. She will now slowly cut.
Right. So Netflix doesn't have any prestigious shows, right? So this is the HBO thing. This is like HBO is very selective with what they buy or has been. Under AT&T, that will change.
AT&T, they've got money.
Yeah.
They have an enormous amount of debt.
Enormous amount of debt.
But they also, like, they got money.
They also have investors who are like, why don't you sell off your entertainment properties? Like, the AT&T at an executive level is, like, the problem with their streaming. Like, half the team is into it, half the team's not, and every HBO executive is out the door.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, that's a whole other situation. But what HBO has that Netflix doesn't is prestige, right? You, like, can turn on HBO Now, and it's, like, a lot of Emmy Award-winning stuff. Apple wants to do the same thing. Apple's buying certain programs that will get them to the Emmys, right? The Morning Show, they want to be an Emmy-nominated thing. Arguably, probably same with C. It's not going to happen, but, you know, these are types of shows.
C is the Jason Momoa is blind.
Jason
Momoa
is blind, yeah. That's what they're trying to do. It's what Amazon does. I mean, look at the recent Emmys. Besides HBO, the only other company people were talking about was Amazon, which was like a weird thing. Like, Amazon owned the Emmys this year. And so for a while, like, I got a text from my mom. Like, this is what I think about when I write stories for The Verge about streaming, is my mom texted me and she was like, TV got really confusing. And I was like, yeah. And she was like, how do I watch TV? And I said, well, do you have Amazon? And she was like, no. And so she's like, I just want to watch these shows. So I suggested piracy. Then I was like, listen, you can probably watch this somehow. But then she eventually got Amazon, and now all she does is watch Amazon Prime stuff. And she's like, also buying toilet paper. She's like, did you know you can buy toilet paper on Amazon? I was like,
this is fantastic.
But that's my, and that's this person. Like, these are the people that Apple wants to get to, where it's like, hey, like, my dad, for example, owns everything Apple. He's 72, walks around with AirPods everywhere.
Beautiful.
Yeah, he's amazing. And he's the guy, he's like, I'm going to get Apple TV Plus because I already have music and I already have news. And I'm just going to watch TV on my iPad. And like, those, like, that's what Apple's going for. They're like, hey, we're going to do good shows that you're paying attention to, that you'll care about. So you get my mom, who's like, I want to watch it. I watch the Emmys. How do I do this? And my dad, who's like the biggest Apple stan, and is like, oh, it's already here, so I'm just going
to
buy it.
So this is, you were talking about Netflix. All it has is subscribers. Netflix has to convince you to pay some money a month.
Yeah.
That's all they can do.
Yeah.
Or they convince T-Mobile to give it to you for free.
Yeah.
But that's like, to make a bundle like that, they got to go out into the world.
Yeah.
And then someone else has to subsidize it. Apple is giving away Apple TV Plus.
Basically free.
For free.
Yeah.
To iPhone owners for what?
1 year.
1 year?
Yeah. And five of their friends via family sharing.
Yeah. Although Apple's family sharing is not the same as just like simple password sharing. Yeah. Like, it's, you like have to, like, commit. Thing. You're, yeah, like, now you're part of my iCloud storage. Like, that's, I don't know. So you stay away from there. But Apple gets to bundle it into the phone. So everyone's going to get it free for a year if they upgrade to a phone.
Yeah.
That's an instant. They're going to juice their numbers. After that year, how will they get you to convert? They will try to sell you another phone.
Yeah.
They will sell you another iPad. Like, at some point, they're just going to give it away for some.
Or they'll have
number.
A bundle, and they'll just be in the ecosystem.
Right. Or they'll have a bundle. It's weird they didn't announce it yet. It feels like they will.
Yeah, there was like a report about how the music labels were like, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
Which sort of makes sense. Amazon obviously has the world's most famous bundle in Prime.
Yep. Great bundle.
Disney Plus, like I said, Verizon's going to give it away. If you have unlimited data on Verizon or you have Fios, you get Disney Plus. I have Fios. That's great. hey, look at that. So they're just giving it away. They're making that deal. Disney also has theme parks.
Yeah, and you're going to get bundles. If you want to spend what you're spending on Netflix with Disney, you can get Hulu, ad-supported Hulu, and ESPN Plus for free, too. They're just throwing it all in.
But Disney gets to subsidize it with their other huge businesses.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So even if they don't have streaming rights to Marvel movies and Disney Plus right now, like, they still make Marvel movies oh, make a ton of money forever and ever and ever.
And they're also being incredibly smart, which is, you know, Kevin Feige, who's the archetype of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He's now working with Disney Plus specifically to do Marvel TV shows. And the Marvel TV shows now interact directly with the Marvel movies. And so it's like, hey, you're watching the show. If you go watch Doctor Strange, there's a thing in Doctor Strange that happens in the show in WandaVision that you have to watch. And so they kind of did this with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but those were bad shows. So nobody watched it and they stopped. But under like this one thing, like, there's a chance that it's like, well, I have to get Disney Plus because I am a Marvel stan. Like, that's what I am. And it's like, well, if I want to know what's happening in Doctor Strange, I have to watch this show.
Or you can just read the Wikipedia entry for the movie.
This is what Jake, editor at The Verge, says to me every morning, and it breaks my heart. I'll be like, Jake,
wait,
I have
every morning he's like, I can just read the Wikipedia page for Doctor Strange.
Yeah, he's like, come in with a theory about Iron Man. And I'm like, I have a new theory. And he's like, I don't care.
Is your theory that you change your mind and Iron Man 2 is bad?
No, Iron Man 2 is great. It's no, I come in every day with new theories based on my brain.
This is what working at The Verge is like. Everyone wants a tour, and I feel like we could just do a podcast of Julia screaming at Iron Man 2, and it would just like being in the office. So AT&T has like a wireless service.
Right.
And they have the rest of the Warner Media empire.
Right.
So they can just subsidize whatever they're doing too.
They'll 100% do that, yeah.
So that just leaves Netflix. Netflix, I don't know, a year ago was the big dog.
Yeah.
Everyone was scared of it. Everyone thought they were like a super bundle. Now that seems very precarious.
Yeah, so Netflix has – the biggest thing Netflix has that they need to figure – this is what they need to basically build upon, and this will be 2020 for them. They have to see if they can do it, which is they have to stop caring about the United States. And to an extent, they have. They're kind of like, I don't care about this as a market anymore. Their only market they care about is international because it's a place that AT&T is not going to. Comcast, which has their own streaming service coming out, Peacock, with NBC Universal.
Amazing name.
Yeah.
I feel like it's important now to disclose.
Oh, right.
Comcast is an investor in Vox Media, the parent company of The Verge. They don't like us very much because they named their service Peacock, and we told people that they named their service Peacock.
Yeah,
which
that's
is a horrible
upsetting.
Name.
It's a terrible horrible name. It's even a bad logo. They don't even use the bird. It's just a line of dots. It's fine.
Wait, it's not even the bird?
It's a line of dots. Just a... It makes me so upset. So these two services are not going international. Let's throw in Quibi because I love Jeffrey Katzenberg. Quibi's probably not going international. Quibi's probably not going many places. So what we have is Netflix and Disney in terms of international play. Disney's going to take some time before they're in certain markets. And they also are doing the smart thing, which is their... Instead of they're doing the Disney thing, which is instead of trying to launch in a company like India, they're just buying Indian streaming services. And they're like, great, great. You're now part of us. And we're just going to do this. They're probably going to be the first major streaming service to launch in China because they have such a very good they have a really good relationship with China. It's why Bob Iger, when asked if he would comment on China, said, nope, that's a really bad business decision for us.
Wow.
Yep. So I mean, like, so they have Disney poses the greatest threat to Netflix in that regard, but it's going to take some time. If Netflix can figure out a way to become a dominant force in India, and it is not right now, a dominant force in South America, Netflix is going to be fine because those are paying subscribers coming in at a cheaper subscription rate. They're designing specifically for mobile in India because more people watch Netflix on their phones than anywhere else in India. And so, like, Netflix, this is the only thing they care about. Like, it's the they like produce shows for America, but they're like, no, like, it's fine. It's also why if you open up Netflix, you see a lot of international shows on your homepage. It's because it's like, yep, that's what we have to do. They also are on top of the quota game that no other services, like if to operate in Europe, you have to have 30% of that content on your service. Netflix has that.
Like 30% European content.
Yeah, like you have to have that. Netflix is partnered with major studios around the world. So like that's why people, that's why investors, they're worried because publications like The Verge or Hollywood Reporter write stories that are like Netflix should be worried. And then the investors go, ooh, now we're worried. But realistically, Netflix is so far ahead that it's fine. I think like the conversation that really needs to happen with streaming services is that the United States is so oversaturated entertainment-wise already that the idea of 4 or 5 services launching within 6 months of each other, vying for people to spend money, the theory is that it's just going to push people back towards cable because it's like it racks
or
up
a
so
bundle.
Quickly. Or a
Some
bundle.
Some sort of aggregate.
Yeah, skinny bundles. And so like that's the thing that we're going to see play out, which is how do people figure out what they subscribe to? Because that doesn't include sports. Right. Doesn't include music. I guess with Disney it does because you can get Spotify with Hulu. It all comes back to Disney. But yeah.
Wait, so let me ask you, but are these like winner take all markets? Like, I don't know. iOS and Android are sure. Somewhat like winner take all. Like you get one and that's what you got.
Yeah.
And you're not going to have both unless you're me and Dieter.
Yeah.
which is a fact. Or probably most people listening to this. But you can have Disney Plus and Netflix and you're still way ahead of a cable bundle.
Yeah. So I did the math the other day for myself because I'm trying to be better with spending. I think with all the streaming services that I have, my most expensive being NBA League Pass, which is $20 a month for my team. I'm spending $90 a month on streaming services. That includes music and that includes new subscription. And so it's not terrible. It's still cheaper than just cable for TV and movies alone. But I am single, like, serving. It's just me. And I use my parents' Netflix because I'm a millennial. versus, like, you know, my parents have cable, but my parents, like, we've got my niece goes over and so they want to have like kid stuff. And like my brother was living at home and like he wanted certain sports packages. And so they are never going to give up the cable package because for them it just gets more expensive at that point. Right. Because they're like, OK, if we're adding on all these different things and it gets more complicated.
That is happening, right? Like cord cutting is real. The cable companies know it. That's why all these people are moving to streaming. Yeah. So you see that pressure. I just wonder, like, with so many, particularly software companies that we cover, they are all like winner take all.
Right.
And that's why, I don't know, like Facebook buying Instagram is bad.
Right.
Because they were once competitors, but now they're the same company in Facebook.
Well, this is the Disney situation, right?
And Disney buys everything. But the Netflix is doomed conversation, or the like, here's all this competition for Netflix. It doesn't seem like Netflix is just going to disappear or lose.
No.
It might not just be the only winner.
Yeah. I mean, I think I tweeted this once is like, the idea that it's a streaming war is like a weird term because war specifies like a winner loser situation. It's more like a streaming arms race, right? It's kind of like who gets the most ammo at a certain time and then controls more of a market and all that kind of fun stuff. Yeah, most people are going to have multiple services. The other thing that was streaming specifically, which is what people like, is most people can just cancel whenever they want.
Right.
Right. You cancel HBO after Game of Thrones and then you go back. Well, I guess there's no more Game of Thrones. You go back for like Watchmen or whatever.
Whereas cable makes that very difficult.
Exactly. Trying to get out of a cable package, like trying to get out of a gym membership. It's like you've like signed your life away. Like, I don't know how you've done it, but it's super easy. The one thing about Netflix, I spoke to an analyst and he was like, Netflix feels like the one channel. Like when you open TV Guide in 1999, and it was like, oh, this is the channel that it opens up to. Like, that's Netflix. It's such background for so many people that it's like, eh, and I'm already plugged in. I can have four people on this plan. It's not a big deal. I don't think there's a winner-loser situation here. I think what we'll see 1,000% is companies like my bet. Like, I could be wrong, but my bet is Warner and AT&T and Comcast realizing that it's really hard to run a streaming service, like just technologically-wise, like product-wise, it's difficult. Maintaining those rights is difficult, and I think they'll just go back to licensing their content because they own very important, very expensive content. And instead of trying to buy it back for themselves on a streaming platform that might not work, because look at CBS All Access, which is another platform everyone forgets about, but like they can just sell that to Netflix, right? And Netflix is very happy to be like, yeah, if we're there's less competition and we have to spend more, but we're the exclusive home of Friends, The Office, and all this stuff. They'll just do that. And I think we'll see more of that happen.
My prediction is that the AT&T...
What is a Go 90 on it?
It's like the Go 90 scale of doing streaming services. AT&T is just like, it just lives at 75. Like, the president of HBO quit today to go be the CEO of Luminary, a podcast startup that has approximately 2 users.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, like, if you're quitting HBO... If someone's like, you can be the president of HBO, and I'd be like, yes. Like, before the sentence even finished, I'd be like, that's a, yep, want that on my, and then it's like, wait, I need to leave here for a podcasting startup that no one uses.
Yeah, I mean, you can, like, look at the last 6 months of AT&T and HBO specifically and be like, John Stankey, who heads up Warner Media at AT&T, being like, people who, at HBO who didn't agree with our vision, well, they could just leave. And then everyone at HBO left. And it was like, I'm glad you're trying to sell your product on October 29th to investors, which is when that happens. When we'll get a price point. We don't even have a price point for it yet.
Yeah. And there are many reports about them arguing about how much it costs.
Minimum, it's 15. Which was it's the most expensive then at that point.
Well, I mean, it's going to get bundled in with your mid-range Android phone. Yeah. Like, if you're looking for a reason to buy like an LG E6 on AT&T, it's like free HBO Max. Like that's how they're going to move those phones. Last question of this segment.
Yeah.
How do you you said product, that perked me up. Do you think these apps are actually going to make a difference to people? Because we actually haven't seen any of these apps. We've only talked about the shows, but like the product experience of Netflix is very good. They've innovated, right? They did the Black Mirror thing with the Choose Your Own Adventure. It doesn't seem like Apple's app is fine. It's weird. Apple's app is actually weird on other platforms. So it doesn't support surround sound on Roku and Amazon or Atmos. It doesn't support Dolby Vision on any of it. Like it's at its best on the Apple TV 4K.
Yeah.
And it is definitely a little like less good on other platforms, which makes sense because you can't imagine people at Apple who were like assigned to write the Fire TV app were like stoked.
Does it like break your heart a little if I say that I watch all of my TV, like all of it on like Safari, like in my computer?
That's fine.
That's how I watch everything.
That's probably the best screen that you got.
Yeah, that's a whole other issue I have with this MacBook, but it's fine.
But no, but that's like it's like a question I have is not only do they have to ship shows, they have to ship apps. The apps have to work.
I have a very good answer for you. One that got me in trouble with Disney today. My thing, go look at the App Store, look up ESPN, and just look at the latest reviews of ESPN Plus, which is the streaming service based on BAM technology, which is what Disney bought for Disney Plus. So it's the same platform. Not great.
Yeah.
It's every review is one star, and it's like, this is a terrible app. It's nothing.
So I pay for ESPN Plus.
It's terrible.
It's $4 a month or something with whatever deal I got. I pay for it for one show. I watch one show a week on it. It's NFL primetime, which I was like, if you're an NFL fan, great show to watch. It is a mess.
Yeah.
Like it is just a messy app.
Yeah, and Disney Plus is launching on the same. So from what I understand from sources from the company, they've allocated way more attention to Disney Plus because Bob Iger is specifically looking over it. But it's still,
We'll see. I think that's actually an undercovered. Everyone's taking it for granted.
I agree.
That you can build a streaming service and put an app and have the app be good. And it's like, have you looked at apps?
Well, that's Netflix's whole thing. Netflix is like, they basically were like, we run 400 to 500 A/B tests a year, and that's just like that's our most important thing because the recommendation algorithm is the most important thing that Netflix that they use. But that's just part of their day. Like their tech department is like the quintessential part of the Netflix experience. They have said that a lot, and it's like, yeah, it's great. Put on Netflix and it's fun. It's like a thing to do. Hulu still kind of sucks to use. No offense to Hulu. HBO Now is, like, basic at its core. So we'll see what HBO Max looks like. But Netflix is good. Netflix is, like, fun to use. Whether or not Disney is like that, I mean, I tried a version of it. I wrote about it for The Verge. And what I used was fine, but it was a beta, and it was in controlled setting. It was at D23, which is Disney's conference. So we'll see what it's like in the wild. I do know, like, their executive, Michael Paul, who runs streaming services, told me that they are super concerned about day one, like, crashes. So, like, I mean, we'll see. Like, we'll see how it goes.
All right. We got to take a break. I want to talk to you about what's going on the other side of streaming, which is all the people getting paid to leave Twitch. But we got to take a break. We'll be right back. All right. Paul Miller.
Uh-huh.
Every week, you hold America together in these times of strife. So there's a segment that's just consistently called...
Our best banana phone yet.
And it would be amazing if all of America was listening to this podcast. They're like, I don't know what's going on in this impeachment situation, but that banana phone's coming.
It is. It's a message of optimism. Okay. So there was a banana phone, right? But it was like, you know, it was like it was Indiegogo, Kickstarter. It was bad. It was a banana phone. And that's hilarious. And that's great. It's a Bluetooth headset for your real phone that looks like a banana. And it worked. It just was really bad. But it was so successful that it merited a sequel that improves the talk time on your banana phone. It works as a really bad Bluetooth speaker now. Anyways, I'm just letting you know. Yeah, so first banana phone, Indiegogo in 2017. And now here we are, 2019, with all the strife, all the challenges that we've faced as people and as a country, and we're getting a new banana phone.
I'm excited for it. We should do a whole show on banana phones next week.
I'm ready for it.
All right, Julia. Now to segue from the banana phone. Let's talk about the banana phone that is professional video game streaming. There's a lot of action here.
Oh man, it's been crazy.
Big platforms coming for Twitch stars, throwing down the cash, trying to launch with celebrities.
It's amazing.
What's going on?
Yeah, so there's a lot happening. It was funny today, Bijan, who is our Twitch reporter, DM me and was like, we cover the same things in a lot of ways. And I was like, yeah, like streaming. And he's like, no, like Disney. I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense, because he just put up this very good interview with the co-founders of a service called Caffeine. Caffeine is really interesting. It's kind of like a take on Twitch, but meets like Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's kind of like they want everyone to stream together and have this social experience, but you can use like shows and movies on top of games. And the reason why it's exciting is that Disney is backing it to an extent. Fox is an investor. So it's like an exciting moment where these major companies are getting involved and trying to basically find their way into the world that Amazon and Microsoft currently own, right? And I guess YouTube. But
YouTube.
Because they have a streaming thing, but yeah, so like caffeine is a really important moment. Offset from Migos, I think he's still with Migos, like he joined and he was like super into it. So like that's one thing that's happening where you've got more streaming services launching with backings from major companies. And on the other side of things, we have what are basically just talent fights, which is something that's very common in sports, very common in traditional entertainment, new to streaming. So today, a popular streamer who goes by Shroud, he's one of Twitch's biggest guys. He joined Ninja in joining Mixer exclusively. That's Microsoft's own streaming service. And that's two big losses for Amazon's owned Twitch. And so those are kind of what we're seeing happening is a lot of attention and a lot of money being paid to personality-based streaming, which is something I wouldn't have said 2 years ago.
So let me – I say these deals. It's cool. Competition. That's my thing. Yeah. I love it. which one does AT&T own again? But there's a very clear corollary to me, and I don't know if it's correct or not. We saw Instagram come in and spend a lot of money trying to get YouTubers to use IGTV.
IGTV.
It went approximately nowhere.
Yeah.
Is this the same deal?
Arguably, no. So I know very little about Instagram, the way it works. So I talk a lot to Ashley Carman, who's our very good reporter, about this a lot. And the question I always have for Ashley is, like, she'll bring me something about an influencer, and I go, but does Instagram have ad revenue the way that YouTube and Twitch have ad revenue, which is like you watch, you subscribe, like there's something there. And she's like, no, it's still sponsorship. Like,
yeah, it's influencer deals. Yeah.
Right, they make deals. Mixer, and I believe, if I remember correctly from Bijan's Caffeine post, Mixer, Caffeine, YouTube, Twitch are all have decent ad breakdowns, right? So, ad revenue breakdowns. So no matter what you do, you're going to earn some kind of money. And I think that's what keeps them apart. I think that's what keeps people going is like, if I stream for 6 hours and people watch, then I get some form of ad revenue from this. And it keeps me going. The difference we're seeing now, and this is where I think Instagram comes into play, because I'm sure Instagram did this with YouTubers and influencers, is now we're seeing companies like Microsoft reportedly give people, big personalities, like 7-8-figure deals.
Yeah, just cash up front.
Just cash up front and come over and stream. You don't have to worry about burnout, which is a huge thing on Twitch, arguably bigger on Twitch than it is on YouTube. You don't have to worry about the toxic space that Twitch is in a lot of ways. Like Twitch right now is like a huge racism problem. I mean, they always do, but like right now it's really rampant. And so companies like Mixer are going, yeah, there's like less viewers, so you're probably not going to have as many on Twitch. It's not as big, but we'll give you 8 figures. You come over, you stream however much you want, take vacation. It's a nice package.
And IGTV, they were paying popular creators who are popular at creating Instagram content to create a new type of content.
Right. No, they paid straight up YouTubers to jump.
Well, but even then, it's a new format, you know.
But did they pay for exclusivity?
I mean, yeah, they did a lot of things.
They did a lot of things, yeah, okay.
Right. But
I just feel like for me, I've watched a lot of Shroud because, like, I never got super into ninjas. He's fun to watch. But if you want to go on Twitch and watch probably the best first-person shooter player that is a full-time streamer, that's Shroud.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, sometimes you're in the mood for like a real niche speed run of like a Zelda randomizer or something like that. But sometimes you want to just watch the best planet that's available on a live stream, a best first-person shooter player, and that's Shroud. And he's just there all the time. And now he's not there. Now he's on a different place. So like Ninja had no draw for me to go over to Mixer. But I would definitely go over to Mixer just to check in on Shroud, you know, get 7 headshots in 2 minutes, you know?
Well, this is the question that's popped up on Twitter, which I think has been the question between, you know, YouTube and Twitch did this for a long time. YouTube and Twitch traded like exclusivity things and people always went back to YouTube because it was just a bigger audience and the ad breakdown was better. And it was VOD. So that's a little bit easier for a lot of people.
Yeah, Casey and I sat when he would, ages ago, he was on and he was like, YouTube had better watch out because Twitch is coming. And that moment came and went.
Yeah, then he went on Twitch and then 2 months later, he was no longer on Twitch. Yeah. We talked about it. It's a different beast. It's a whole different beast. But we see that happen a lot with them. The conversation that happened there, it's happening now, is do you follow the platform or do you follow the personality, right? And I know for me, I'm a personality-based person. I will just go to where my like, I follow about 30 to 40 YouTubers regularly. And if they were all, like, going to Mixer, I don't know why they would do that, but I'd be like, sure. I will spend all my time on Mixer. That's where I'm going to go. It didn't work out well for YouTube and Twitch then. Everyone kind of went back to their platforms where they felt very comfortable and where they found their audience. But Mixer and Twitch are more similar than Twitch and YouTube.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see how that plays out. The thing is, my opinion on it, is that YouTube is the real winner in this situation. Because Microsoft and Amazon are going to be spending a lot of money to get them to be exclusively streaming on their platforms. And then YouTube doesn't have to spend any money, but all their VOD clips end up on YouTube. And so YouTube goes, great. Well, people are going to come here and spend time watching the clips because they don't want to watch 8 hours of a thing. We'll throw our top ads on it because you're family friendly, really. So we'll throw Nike and whatever ads on it. And YouTube just makes bank. And it's like, great. like YouTube YouTube is like very happy to be like, yes, fight with each other. And then
but it seems like YouTube, I mean, you laughed, like YouTube's in this mix too with live streaming, but they're not really.
Not really. I mean, they have a live streaming thing, but it's like a dumpster fire. It's like, The live streams they recommend are like really bad live streams. The gaming live streams themselves are not like situated in a way that is discover friendly for a lot of creators. They kind of took like the Facebook Watch approach to live streaming, and I don't understand it. I'm like, I don't know why you would mess with a platform that works really well, like what you have going for you.
Because you're big and all you can think about is getting bigger. It's very obvious what happens here.
One of the things that's so frustrating with YouTube, Twitch right out of the gate was like, okay, chat. What else is like chat? Oh, IRC. IRC is chat. People have moderated IRC chats for centuries. We will bring those best practices. They didn't necessarily scale to like a 20,000 viewer thing. They definitely don't scale to, you know, 100,000 viewers simultaneously. But they do scale for a traditional channel on Twitch. YouTube's like, what's moderation?
it's terrible. I mean, I think you look at the amount of politicians right now who are like launching Twitch channels, and I guess one of those being Donald Trump. But like, you look at all these people who are launching Twitch channels, and it's like they're not launching YouTube live streams for their rallies, like where they're on Twitch. Like, they'll just live stream their rallies, and then they'll have members from their teams kind of in chat, like keeping things somewhat moderated and talking to people. And no one's on YouTube. And YouTube is out here like vying for them to be there. Like, they're like, hey, come to our platform. Like, we're popular too. But no one's going. And it's because anytime you open up a live stream of a YouTube video, for the most part, it is just terrible. It's just like the chat is terrible. What people are saying is terrible. I always get recommended QAnon things. I don't watch any QAnon thing. And I'm like, I don't know why this is being recommended to me.
That's perfect.
But yeah, so I mean, it's they're kind of non in this conversation, aside from the VOD, which is where they're happy to be.
I think the idea that there's now a lot of competition in this zone and you're seeing talent deals is going to tell us a lot about how sticky these platforms actually are.
Yeah, I just think like it's fun to think about like kids who are like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 now growing up can actually be like, I want to play video games for a living. And their parents who are like youngerish are like, yeah, well, look at Ninja. Versus like, if I was like to my parents, I would like to play Pokemon all day, every day and get paid for it. I would get like slaps. They'd be like, what are you talking about?
Well, you know, we had the CEO of Logitech on the show 2 weeks ago. And like, if you just listen to him, all of their moves are, okay, we sell a microphone, we sell a webcam, we bought Streamlabs, we sell all the gaming peripheral. Like, he's like, this is a market. Like, people want to do this. We're gonna build the entire stack for you outside of your actual PC to do this task. And it's like, that's just, you can see that business is growing.
Well, it's interesting, right? I mean, in terms of like, you think about how fast Twitch is growing, how to an extent fast Mixer is growing, and then YouTube bring YouTube. Every time someone brings up traditional competition with entertainment and subscription-based streaming, Reed Hastings at Netflix is always like, our competition is YouTube and Facebook. Like, that is what we have to compete with.
I think that's aspirational.
I think he's basically saying,
be honest,
like
no, how about that? Like, that implies that, like, all of your time in the day is sucked up by like YouTube, Facebook, and Netflix. And he's like, I got to get more of YouTube time. And it's like, no, I think there are other people who maybe are going to take that slice of the pie, Reed. But it's nice that he's thinking that way. I enjoy the ambition.
It's also nice that, like, it's funny because Netflix is like, we want to be YouTube. And every YouTuber I know who's like of a decent popularity is like, how do I get a Netflix deal? And I was like, you guys should talk. Like, you guys want each other's things.
That's beautiful. Well, I think it's safe to say we're proud of everyone. Okay, that's the Vergecast. thank you for listening. I'm going to start ending the show like that every week. Like, I'm all of you, burnouts and success stories alike, we're proud of you. Giant billionaire CEOs and dude in the car.
John Hughes would be so proud of you.
Oh, we're all together. It's all one family that's locked in Apple's ecosystem. Please share your iCloud storage with me. That's the Vergecast. We're back on Tuesday. Paul, this one's just for you. I interviewed Amber Baldé, who is a blockchain expert, talking about the future of the blockchain. That's coming up on Tuesday. Thursday, we're taping our live show in San Francisco. Isaac Reynolds, he's a product manager of the Pixel Camera, and Robbie Stein, who's the director of product for Instagram. I've been dying to have this conversation for a long time, so Ashley and Dieter and I are going to be on stage with them. You can go to our website. You can try to get tickets. You can get on the wait list. Hopefully, we're going to open up some more. We're sold out right now, but that's coming out the next day. I think that's going to be just a great conversation. I was just on Vox Media's newest podcast, Reset, with Ariel Dehem Ross, talking about China, actually. That came out. Go subscribe to Reset. It's a great show. Ariel is a former Verge reporter. She's one of the best Verge reporters ever come through the building, and now she's back in the family with Reset. So go check that out. You can subscribe to Dieter's newsletter command line at theverge.com/newsletter. You might have noticed that Dieter isn't here. I'm going to tell you what happened. Dieter had to leave the show. He stopped us in the middle of taping and said, "There's breaking RCS news, and I'm the only one who can handle it," and ran away. That's a real thing that happened with Dieter. You can tweet at him. He's at Backline. I'm not making that up.
He tried to make it sound like it was a big imposition, but you could tell.
He was so happy.
He's so stoked.
Anyway, Dieter is currently writing a breaking RCS story.
He was one, like, glasses pull away from entering Superman mode. He's like, I'm the only one.
So please read and share Dieter's RCS story. He's at Backline. I know he would appreciate hearing from you. Julia, what's your Twitter?
At LoudmouthJulia.
Paul?
Future Paul.
I'm at Reckless. You can tweet at us. We'll see you next week. That's the Vergecast. Rock and roll.
Paul.